Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of September 2017. Welcome to episode 28 of this podcast. The concept of the show is to just have a brief chat about what comics I've read since the last time we had one of these brief chats, which would make it pretty much the books I read during September. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost them on Facebook and Twitter so you can find those. But those posts aren't really spoilers for this podcast, since those are just lists. And here we do a little more review, a little more critique, a little more discussion. But first, a little feedback. Karen from the Between the Pages blog said she likes it when I cover Gold Key, Harvey, Disney, and Archie books here on the show. Well, get ready for more of that, Karen. Iowa's Joe Crawford seemed to be live-tweeting last month's episode. First, he commented on the Don Rosa Uncle Scrooge book that Mark Sweeney sent in that he requested I leave behind in a waiting room. If Mark ever sends you any more Don Rosa, if you forward them to me, A, I won't tell Mark, and B, I'll make sure to read them in a doctor's waiting room. I promised him that if it was still in that doctor's office next time I went, maybe I'd reacquire the book for him. Joe said, that sounded good. We just shouldn't tell Mark. At which point, Mark chimed in. You know I can read these comments, right? We both promised to send Iowa's Joe's way anything like that came to us. He said he appreciated it. I've got a soft spot for the Ducks because of Dad. And Rosa, along with Mark's, just happens to be a favorite. And among the people who liked that post was Don Rosa's official Twitter feed, which is curated by his editor. A bit later, Iowa's Joe wondered if, in fact, I did just call Reed Richards Stretchy McJerkface. If so, you win best nickname ever given to Mr. F. Yes, it was something close to that. I just can't find it in myself to call that loser fantastic. Ugh. And then after getting through the whole episode, he tweeted about the fact that Black Magic number 2 was my favorite book of last month. He was the one that sent me issue 1. Great episode. This is the closest I think I've come to sending you the book of the month. One day, the victory shall be mine. Ha 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 ha. You know, Iowa's Joe, it's not a competition. There are no prizes. I mean, just so you know, buddy. Just so you know. And Darren Sutherland wrote in talking about a book I read a few months ago, one of the Free Comic Book Day books. Hi, Professor Allen. I was listening to your latest CRJ episode today, and I had a thought as he talked about the juvenile sleuth book Bad Machinery. Have you read the manga Detective Conan? It's better known in the U.S. as Case Closed. While the Japanese title Detective Conan is an homage to Sherlock Holmes, the series was unable to be published here with that name because of the threat of a lawsuit related to the name Conan. The lawsuit was not brought about by the estate of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, which is where the name comes from. Instead, it was related to Conan the Barbarian, a title that has absolutely nothing to do with a detective mystery series. I wonder if anyone who threatened the lawsuit ever looked at the book, or if they just assumed it was related. Oh well, thanks for another great episode, Darren. Well, Darren, thanks for another great piece of feedback, buddy. And yes, trademark law is a very funny thing. Just asked Captain Marv... Shazam. And now, on to the books I read last month, as we do here in the Reading Journal, categorizing the books that I read. And first are the issues I read specifically for podcast appearances, the homework books. for episode 108 of The Quarter Bin. I read Marvel Team-Up 144 featuring Spider-Man and the underrated and awesome Moon Knight. And for episode 109, I read Marvel Superheroes Magazine number 1, which reprints full-length stories featuring the FF, Daredevil, Iron Man, and Hulk. In comics I read for listening to podcasts, I recently picked up a G.I. Joe digest. I think this was from the World's Greatest Comics Cheap Bins, but I'm not sure. A listener may have sent it in, as it's just the right size for packing material. But however I got it, it was pretty perfect timing, as it contained the stories that Aaronhead Moss and his team would be covering on G.I. Joe, A Real American Headcast. So to read along with episode 15 of that show, I read G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, number 15. And it was a really good story. Lots of high stakes battling in the air. Haven't read a G.I. Joe comic in multiple decades, but this one was pretty good. In terms of podcast-adjacent books, there are a few, I suppose, but specifically one I'll mention here. As documented on both Relatively Geeky Presents number 7 and Dorkness to Light number 12, the family took a trip to Europe early this summer, and the German portion had a religious bent to it, as it was organized around 2017 being the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther beginning what would become the Protestant Reformation. And I picked up a graphic novel, one of the few that I found there that had been translated into English, and that was Martin Luther, A Monk Changes the World. It was good. Look for a longer review on the Dorkness to Light blog. On to new comics that we read right off the shelves, and these are all from DC, Rebirth Books. Green Arrow 29, Ollie continues his hard travels, this time spending quality time with Batman in Gotham City. They have some pretty good conversations, and Batman actually talks sense into Ollie, which is pretty funny, actually. And back in the Star City, formerly known as Seattle, Canary and Emmy have discovered some major evidence that may clear Ollie of his murder charge, but they have to run a gauntlet to get to that evidence. Green Lanterns 29 and 30. Our heroes are billions of years in the past, trying to turn a half dozen or so potential lanterns into an actual fighting force. And at the end of issue 29, the ancient lanterns have said the famous oath and are off to fight Volthoom, the first lantern. And despite all the training and passion that these new lanterns have, they get their butts handed to them something good. And Simon, showing his courage in battling without having a ring at all, earns more rings and finds himself going toe-to-toe with Volthoom. The Hellblazer, 7 through 13. This is one that's been on our pull list from the start, but M gets the first crack at them, meaning I was a bit behind. But she came over on one of her days off from the library, and we did a joint comic book reading catch-up day. And on that day, I read this stack of Hellblazers. Mostly, this is the Smokeless Fire arc featuring Constantine and his friend, Mercury, running around Paris trying to figure out how to stop the coming resurgence of the Djinn. But the people they track down, the clues they get, can't exactly be trusted. Surprising, I know. I like the setting of the story, Paris instead of England. Nice change of pace for Constantine. And in the story, he ran across his old frenemy, Papa Midnight. And there were werewolves. After bringing that storyline to as happy an ending as Constantine gets, the next storyline, The Inspiration Game, started up. This one was written by Tim Seeley instead of Simon Oliver, did the first 12 issues, and seems to indicate that John's dreams and imaginings might have the power to become real things. And as you can guess, he has some pretty disturbing dreams and imaginings. These had a nice combo of spiritual dark stuff, Constantine getting himself totally into trouble, and of course a little bit of humor, mostly at the title character's expense. Super Sons, 6 and 7. These are the Planet of the Capes story. John has been allowed by his folks Clark and Lois to do some superheroing, although he does have a 10 p.m. curfew even on a Friday. And his training is going to be overseen by Damian, at least when he can get away from the Teen Titans, which he very specifically hung out with at one point, leaving poor John behind. He is only 10, not quite ready for the Teen Titans. Except that when the Time Commander attacks the Titans, he ends up being way older than usual, so he ends up not being a teen exactly either. Trinity, 7 through 12 and Annual 1. Picking up after the end of the Black Mercy story, Cullen Bunn wrote the next two issues, 7 and 8, about Ra's al Ghul and Superlex being called into a team-up with Cersei. Yes, that's Cersei, as she tells them. The story continues into the Annual, where Rob Williams and Gilliam March carry it on. And the demon Etrigan appears, invited to replace Luther in this evil trinity, after Lex rejected the offer soundly. And Jason Blood actually gets free of Etrigan, except that without Blood's control, the demon is pretty much an unstoppable global destruction machine. And the heroes force a reunification. In issues 9 through 11, we get back to some writing by Francis Manipal, Dead Space. On his stories, he does the writing and the art, so obviously he needs the fill-ins every now and then. In these stories, the JLA satellite is attacked by aliens who are actually just looking to destroy some other aliens, parasites that are infecting their people. Unfortunately, they start infecting JLA members. And more unfortunately, the alien plans for destroying these parasites now include destroying the Watchtower, which, considering it's falling towards the Earth, because of the infestation, seems like not that crazy a plan. Issue 12 starts a new storyline by writer Rob Williams, and here we get another Trinity interacting with our title characters, the Dark Trinity, if you will, of Zatanna, Constantine, and Deadman. There are a number of nods to the recent J.L. Dark animated movie, which was covered by me and M over on Lucky Episode 13 of Darkness to Light. This story brings Cersei back in from a few issues back and leads these traditional heroes into the world of magic, and they plumb don't like it. And they don't like to depend on Constantine. I mean, would you like to depend on him? Wonder Woman 29 and 30. These wrap up Shea Fontana's story, Heart of the Amazon. When last we left this title, Diana and Etta were surrounded by a bunch of mercenaries and assassins like Cheshire and Plastique and Cat Eye. It turns out that they were tasked to nab just enough of Diana's blood for an evil research scientist. Turn that into a super soldier serum. As a way of saving many lives, they argue to her. She almost seems to buy that argument, but then they reveal the plan is to kidnap her and just permanently continue to drain her blood. It is a renewable resource, after all. But she ends up escaping and shutting down the scientist. A very different arc than what Greg Rucka was doing, but it's a solid transition. And I think that a James Robinson arc is coming up next, and I'm looking forward to that. On to the general comic reading that I did. The great Kansan Greg Arujo sent some books a while back, and there was one in there that I set aside for future reading, and a circumstance came up where it became a timely read. Our church had an event for couples wanting to renew their vows, and after 30 years, Mrs. Quarterbin and I decided it was time to extend the contract at least another 30 years. And so in honor of that event, I read The Marriage of Hercules and Xena from Topps Comics, 1998. But as soon as they wed, Xena was overtaken by an uncontrollable fury and a desire to kill Hercules. This has happened in this village for over a year, where every wedding has ended with the bride murdering the new groom. Xena and Hercules suspect that there was a curse involved, and when Xena became infected, they knew that was the case. Hercules came up with a plan to free Xena from the curse, which works, and they live happily ever after, except for the marriage part, which was not legit. It was just a hoax, a ruse, to ferret out who was behind the curse. And just to be clear, neither my 1987 wedding nor the 2017 renewal of vows ended up with my wife attempting to kill me. Just so you know. Full disclosure. And Archie's Joke Book 172, a book made up of 25 one-page or half-page gag strips featuring a wide variety of characters, and most of them were adequately funny. Unfortunately, one of them featured Lil Jinx. Not a fan. My buddy, Iowa's Joe Crawford, sent in some books recently, including Curse Words, number one. This is an issue that didn't work for me as well as it should have. It's got fantasy elements, magical beings, and a dimension of people using Earth as a battleground, and a talking koala. And yet the story of a wizard appearing on Earth and doing good, lots of good, and eventually battling another wizard, defeating him, being all heroic. It's like it checked all the boxes, but it just didn't draw me in. I assume this guy probably turns out to be a bad guy, or at least a gray character. But that possibility, the intrigue of that, and the fact of these beings from his home world or home dimension coming after him, even with all that, as sort of good as that sounds, this thing just didn't grab me. And Alpha King, number one, this is from last year, a book written by Brian Azzarello, Nick Floyd, and Simon Bisley. It's a weird book, a combo of D&D and fantasy stuff, along with some real-world character stuff. I don't necessarily recommend it, except to Jason Marcinet from the Heroes and Hops YouTube channel and podcast, because it's a comic book based on a microbrew. Have you ever wondered what would happen if a brewer/gamer fell into his own vat? Well, this comic book is designed to answer that question. And from the discount bins at World's Greatest Comics, I picked up Superman Family 172. This one's from 1975, with reprint stories of Lois Lane, Jimmy Olsen, and Supergirl. The Lois Lane story was pretty good, her playing the long game against Lex Luthor, who seems to have gone straight. They even get married at the end. Or do they? Supergirl was not a bad story either, about an alien who's killing Earth women by marrying them. Now, two out of the three stories in this issue involve major plots about weddings. But that one has a really nice twist. The story is called The Kiss of Death. And Dr. Ange, any recollections on this one? Would be curious for your thoughts. I ask because I kind of liked it. And then there was Jimmy Olsen. Meh. I loved these family titles when I was growing up. So much content. So many stories. I loved it. Even then, I understood the importance of value. Whether I was buying my own books, or more likely my folks or my aunt were buying them. But thick books with lots of stories, totally my thing. And they still are. And back then, I was young enough to both not know about reprints and to not care that I was reading reprints. And so anytime I find any of these books for cheap, Batman Family, Superman Family, Super Team Family, and also DC Special or DC Superstars, I pick them up. Which is why I also grabbed from World's Greatest Comics Super Team Family number 3. Three stories here, all team-ups of one kind or another. We start with The Flash and Hawkman going up against Gorilla Grodd. And DC totally knew what they were doing, putting this story first and making it the largest box on the cover. Actually, it's a Grodd-Hawkman combination, which actually looks pretty cool. And if you have a chance to put a winged gorilla on your cover, of course you're going to do that. So Batman and Superman get a box about the third the size of Hawk Grodd's, And then poor little Green Arrow and Aquaman, they're squeezed into the very bottom of the cover in a box about a third the size of Batman's and Superman's. Very teeny tiny. That Flash, Grodd, Hawkman story was the best of the three, followed by the Superman-Batman team-up, which also featured Batgirl, Jimmy Olsen, Supergirl, and Robin. It was supposedly an alien story and had an interesting premise, but the end was a bit too Silver Age-y for my taste. And Aquaman and Green Arrow, it was barely a team-up and barely a good comic story. This issue also had the most disappointing, most boring hostess ad I've ever seen. Shazam, the cupcake caper. Nothing happened. All the world's cupcakes disappear, and Captain Marvel finds them and finds the culprit, and I don't know. There was no clue followed, no investigation. Just one panel later, he finds them. It's weird and boring. Unlike actual hostess cupcakes, which provide a big delight in every bite. From World's Greatest, I also picked up Millie the Model, 161. Not Stan Lee's best moments as a writer, just between us. Stan has long been a great showman, has had a great winning personality, great storyteller, but I don't know if always he's that great a comic writer. I've read a ton of these light humor comics, and most of them are funnier than this was. It had all the right beats, Millie and her best frenemy, the boy they both like, job-related hijinks. But overall, it was just okay. And Cobra number 5 from 1976. I don't remember much of this title from back then. I may have read one issue back in the day, but I'm pretty unfamiliar with it and with the lead character, too. The best part of the issue was the opening splash page, with Cobra tearing through a comic page, the text claiming that the story intended for this issue has been replaced because we weren't ready for that story just yet. Instead, we're told that we now live in a terrifying nightmare world, the world in which we live, and it's controlled by Cobra. And that's a pretty great pitch for a story. It's just that the rest of the story, the scripting, the art, it just did not live up to that, admittedly, pretty cool premise and pretty great splash page. The comics sent in recently by the generous Canadian Rob Lance of the Comic Connection store in Oakville, Ontario, included Uncle Scrooge 72 from 1967 with reprints from as early as 1957. The lead story has Scrooge and the boys trying to win a boat race as inexpensively as possible, which I can respect. Good story, and the Professor Gearloose backups weren't too bad either. And Archie's girls, Betty and Veronica, 162 and 165. These are from 69 and are pretty fun reads. A couple of these stories leaned a little too hard into the frenemy aspect of B&V with real competition between the two, lacking some of that underlying friendship that should be there. It's interesting that the status quo for these Archie characters do change a bit over time. There is a bit of an ebb and flow to the relationships. And Life with Archie, 62, 74, 76, 93, 101, and 104. These are from the 1967 to 1970 era. The first one just seemed to be wacky for the sake of being wacky. I suppose they were trying to do something different, but it just didn't work for me. And I don't know, maybe 50 years ago it was experimental and exciting, but to this old curmudgeonly guy, it was just weird. But the other issues were a little more standard, more traditional, and better reads. There's a fun story about Archie and Jug doing everything they can to make Archie's mom's life as pleasant as possible, which has the ultimate side effect of making Archie's dad's life not so pleasant. And there was a nice, longer story about Mr. Lodge wanting to sit in with the Archies as he's learning to play guitar. I did want to talk about the letters pages from a lot of these Archie books. The letters are from kids around the world, probably at least 50% of them girls, and they're just writing in about their lives, their pets, their hobbies, vacations they've taken. The best letters in an issue won a few dollars, I think it was like $5 prize for first place. $3 for second place and so on. They may mention a favorite Archie character, but it's not particular nitpicks about stories and issues like every other comics letter page from this era. These are just nice letters, and I imagine with the addresses printed, they spurred a bunch of pen pal relationships. Just kind of a cool snapshot of being a kid in that era. And Sad Sack, 210 and 218 from 1969 and 1971. And these were actually in pretty good shape. Staples intact. They weren't at risk of falling apart while reading. And the stories themselves, you know, they were okay. Sad Sack doesn't have to be repetitive, but these stories and just these two issues had a lot of the same features, same characters, same jokes almost. Last month, I read a giant-size Sad Sack that had a lot of variety in the stories and would have liked to have seen just a bit of that variety present here in these regular-sized issues. Other kid books that I read, mostly from Rob's care package, included Richie Rich Fortunes 19, Richie Rich Jackpots 13 and 21, Beagle Boys 2, Donald Duck 115 and 126, Woody Woodpecker 99 and 103, and Beep Beep the Roadrunner 2, 8, and 9. I do want to talk about a few of these. I want to mention the Beagle Boys issue, because this is an incredibly early version of making the villains titled characters of a book. And this title lingered from here in 1965 all the way up to 79. A total of 47 issues coming out over that time. Also, that earliest issue of Roadrunner number 2, 36 pages of content, no ads. And I'm counting the front and back covers in that. They all included one-page, you know, joke stories. I mentioned that a month or so back about another book and wondered how that played into Gold Key's business model, that is, an entire issue with no ads. Of course, these books sold hundreds of thousands of copies, so the cover price sales may have been enough revenue to make the comic profitable, I don't know. By the time we do get to issue 8 and 9, the inside cover pages had ads, and there may be two other ads in the book. Also, and I know I'm not the only person to say this, it's a very common comparison, but reading these Roadrunner stories made me think of course, the demon Etrigan. Because in the comics, not only do the Roadrunners speak, they speak in rhyme. There are not a lot of rhyming characters, so the few ones that exist, they are going to get compared. Anytime a character speaks in rhyme, you are being invited to participate in a little bit of poetic literary criticism. Now, the rhymes in the Roadrunner books are pretty simple, as would befit a kid's book, and a few of the rhymes were actually a bit clever. So, good work on that, Gold Key writers. And I do need to mention one of the house ads I saw in one of the Richie Rich books. According to this ad, there were at least 12 Richie Rich titles being published in 1976. Over a 5-week period, issues of these titles were all published, although for simplicity's sake, I'm going to drop the words Richie Rich from these titles here, but here they are. Riches, Gems, Dollars and Cents, Success, Bank Books, Poor Little Rich Boy, Richie Rich and Casper, Money World, Billions, Jackpots, Diamonds, and Profits. I did not realize how big a deal Richie Rich must have been at the time. I don't think Batman or The Punisher or Deadpool has ever had a dozen ongoing titles at the same time, but Richie Rich did, and that is crazy talk. But thank you, Rob. A great variety of comics, great choices, and pretty great reads. All right, we're taking a break here, and when we come back, the debut of a doomtastic new feature.
Welcome to Astro City, a Pulp to Pixel podcast, an issue-by-issue ratings and review of the creator-owned comic book series Astro City by the writer-artist team of Kurt Busiek, Brent Anderson, and Alex Ross. You can find episodes of Welcome to Astro City and other Pulp to Pixel podcasts at pulptopixel.blogspot.com, pulptopixel.tumblr.com, through the iTunes store under the Pulp to Pixel podcast, and through Facebook at the Pulp to Pixel podcast webpage.
Man, you come right out of a comic book.
The Pulp to Pixel Podcasts, exploring the media multiverse of geek culture.
And we're back with the first installment of a brand new segment for the show, inspired by podcasting's Michael Bailey. On Facebook, he said that it would be great if I did a regular monthly podcast where I analyzed Doctor Doom comics from, of course, Doctor Doom's perspective, or as I call it, the truth. Without what big comic would have you believe based on their hashtag fake continuity? But as great and needed as that podcast would be, the best that I can do at this point is add this brand new segment right here in the middle of the Comics Reading Journal. And with that, let me welcome you to Dr. Doom's Fireside Chat. In this episode, we'll discuss in fullness and truth two issues of Marvel's greatest comics. I can't speak to the entirety of that series, but clearly these two qualify as being among the world's greatest comics because they contain the world's greatest comic character. We're looking at Marvel's Greatest Comics, 66 and 96, which reprint stories of The Failure 4, 84 and 116, respectively. Issue 66 came from the quarter bins of World's Greatest Comics because the cover was slightly imperfect, moderately defaced, as in it was missing the entire top inch of the cover. Issue 96 was in the dollar boxes, but at World's Greatest Comics annual Celebrate the Store Anniversary Sale, those go on sale for three for a dollar, and that's where I nabbed number 96 from. But first, the cover of Marvel's Greatest Comics, 66, is a recolored version of the original, done by the great Jack Kirby. On it, Dr. Doom looms lovingly over the streets of Latveria, where Crystal and her three chaperones are greeted by a parade or celebration of some type. The good people of Latveria, realizing how fortunate they are to live under the benevolent reign of President for Life Victor I. The story, by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, tells the story of a secret mission given to the four by Nick Fury and Dum-Dum Dugan. And let me just point out one major mistake that Stan Lee made in developing his characters. He created Reed Richards, and he also created a different guy named Dum-Dum. But he totally failed to do the obvious thing and call Reed Mr. Dum-Dum. And his team, the Dum-Dum Four, missed opportunity, Stan, hashtag sad. Anyway, S.H.I.E.L.D. has illegally acquired a fragmented arm of some powerful robot. While examining the arm, it comes back to life. And after a brief battle, the team destroys this piece of private property that they had previously illegally acquired, if I hadn't pointed that out before. They use this as a pretense for a covert invasion of Latveria, where they are discovered by a squad of robot soldiers and taken in to legally justifiable custody. Later, Crystal and the three bozos find themselves in a fairy tale village where everything is love and friendship, otherwise known as Latveria. All they have to do is make the sensible decision to never leave, staying under Dr. Doom's protection. and custody. Forever. And with Doom hypnotically draining their powers because awesome, he decides it's time for a parade. For a Fantastic Four Fiesta Day. Isn't that sweet? Because Doom likes to bring joy and celebration to his people. To all of his people. And now his people include Crystal, Reed, Ben, and Johnny. And they shall be pleased to be under his kindly, benevolent rule. For as Doom pointed out earlier in this issue, in a terrific Jack Kirby splash page, "For no one knows what is best for you, except your mighty sovereign, Dr. Doom." And I credit Stan Lee for getting that translation correct, the subtleties and nuances of Doom's thinking. Lee does a good job with these other Doom quotes, also accurately reflected in this piece of journalistic reporting. "Have I not told you that I dearly love my subjects? The welfare of my people is ever closest to my heart. And how ungrateful are those who will not accept the rule of Dr. Doom." Good stuff. Marvel was on the right track to include this issue in a reprint title called Marvel's Greatest Comics. This is some of Stan Lee's best work reporting on Doom's activities. And Jack Kirby's pencils are absolutely stunning. For economic purposes, Kirby had to supplement his work on Doom-related stories by doing art about Captain America, Nick Fury, and many, many others. But his work on Doom is so strong, so consistently strong, such as in this issue, that Latveria has chosen to acknowledge and celebrate his 100th birthday this year. Well, not exactly celebrate it themselves, but Doom has allowed others to recognize Jack Kirby's birthday without consequences. Another benevolence for which we are grateful. And Kirby did a lot of great art, obviously, and a lot of great Dr. Doom art. And this includes some of the really good stuff. And Kirby is so on his game, as is Stan Lee, that even the parts of the issue that don't deal with Dr. Doom, where we go to the villains of the issue, S.H.I.E.L.D. and the Failure Four, even that stuff is readable. And that's hard to pull off with those characters. So this is a really good issue. Moving on to issue 96, the one that cost me $3 for $1. But since this is not the Quarterbin podcast, Stella, that's okay. The cover of Marvel's Greatest Comics number 96 by John Buscema is again a very slightly recolored version of the original cover, Fantastic Four 116. We get a great shot of the four main characters, the version of the team that actually comes closest to living up to that title, Fantastic. We have coming at us the Thing, Human Torch, whatever, Sue Storm,
she's hot,
and Dr. Doom.
Hail Doom! Hail Doom!
A red circle tells us that this issue contains all new thrills as Reed Richards is replaced by Dr. Doom. It's about freaking time. By the way, Victor Von Doom is the only man that Sue Storm refers to as Mr. Fantastic, if you know what I'm saying. The alliterative story inside, The Alien, The Ally, and Armageddon, was written by Archie Goodwin, with art by John Buscema and Joe Sinnott. We start with the remaining members of the title team reeling after their battle last issue with the so-called Mr. Fantastic, who is now in the thrall of the Overmind. At least, that's what Big Comic would have you believe. Clearly, what has happened is that after nearly 10 years of deceiving the world into considering him a super genius, the man's true nature has been revealed. which is just a mean, mean villain guy and one who's not that bright. But after something crazy like 10 pages of The Thing and Johnny, blah, 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 finally we get to the good stuff. Realizing that Mr. Stretchy-Faced Boopyhead has finally gone over the edge mentally, Sue reaches out, of course, to Dr. Doom. She clearly knows intimate details about Victor, like, say, a heartsick teenager might. She knows he's not in Latveria, knows he's not in Washington, where countries tend to have their primary embassies. But no, somehow Sue knows that to find Victor, she goes to the New York alternate embassy for Latveria. She enters through a side entrance and makes her way quickly through the hallways, avoiding the traps and mazes that are surely there. She easily finds the inner chamber, the personal quarters of Victor Von Doom. You know, it's interesting. You get the idea that this woman has been in this building, in this room, many, many, many times before this. And she gets some quality FaceTime, of course, begging the benevolent leader of Latveria to help. She points out his honor and nobility. And of course, he agrees because he's honorable and noble. Sue brings the doctor to meet Ben and Johnny, and they don't take well to having a new team leader. But of course, they relent, and the team goes up against the Overmind. Ben and Johnny are quickly disposed of. Hello. Doom fights nobly, standing up to the Overmind stronger than anyone else can. Sue helps him with a force shield here and there, and as a team, as a duo, as a couple, they are stronger than ever. The Overmind does indeed get in a good blast on Dr. Doom, but our hero is ready to begin his dramatic, impressive, unbelievable comeback right there against the overwhelming odds of the Overmind. But then some weird alien comes and banishes the Overmind like a deus coming from a machina and brings Reed back to his senses, and then the Watcher arrives, and he explains to the Failure Four that they needed this because otherwise they would have been extremely embarrassed by the impending victory that would have been victoriously victorized by Victor Von Doom. Clearly, this is a case of Big Comic becoming involved in the story and replacing the natural ending of the story, Victor Von Doom defeating the Overmind and claiming Sue Storm as his rightful consort, only to have a really dumb and out-of-the-blue plot point that, let's be honest, is both terrible and makes no sense. When you have to bring in both the Stranger and the Watcher in the last four pages of your story, it's because the story was naturally going a way you didn't want. It's shameful. It's embarrassing. It's what we expect from Big Comic. I mean, you have this great setup. Reed out of commission. Sue seeking out her heart's one true desire, fighting side by side with Doom. And you end the story instead with the Stranger and the Watcher? Guys, just tell the story as it was meant to be. That's all we ask. Hashtag fake continuity. Hashtag sad. And by the way, this is the final issue of Marvel's Greatest Comics ever published. That's how bad they messed up the end of the story, that they basically decided to burn the building down. There was no way they were ever going to be able to dig themselves out of the pit that the end of this story put them in. So they just stopped making the book. Okay. I gotta calm down. I love the idea of this new segment. Thank you, Podcasting's Michael Bailey, for the idea. But look, I just gotta play a promo here. When we come back, we'll talk about all the other things I read this month. Trades, miniseries, long runs, and graphic novels.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles! Hi, I'm Tim from Cord Industries, the Blue Beetle blog. I'm here to tell you about an exciting new addition to the Silver and Gold family of podcasts. The show is Beetlemania, and it focuses on what is arguably one of the greatest superheroes in all of comics history, Blue Beetle. From the adventures of Dan Garrett the cop in the 1930s to Dan Garrett the archaeologist in the 1960s, from everyone's favorite Ted Kord to the more recent adventures of Jaime Reyes, we'll be covering the entire legacy of the Blue Beetle. And I won't be doing it alone. Joining me for this epic journey through the lives of the Blue Beetle will be Jay from the Silver and Gold Podcast. Together, we'll be discussing, reviewing, and celebrating the awesomeness of all of the Beatles. Beetlemania, coming soon to sngpod.com and cordindustries.blogspot.com.
And we're back. On to the trades, graphic novels, miniseries, and long runs that I read. In episode 100 of The Quarterbin, Clinton Robinson and I talked about an issue of Magnus Robot Fighter from Valiant. And my comment was something along the lines of, if I find some more issues of that for cheap, I'd definitely think about picking them up. And then, like magic, some appear in the Quarterbins at World's Greatest Comics. So I read Magnus, Robot Fighter, 22, 24, 25, and 26. John Ostrander wrote these issues, and that's never a bad thing. At this point, the robots have come pretty close to taking over the Earth of 4002. For this storyline, Holocaust 4002, the fall of North Am. So robots have taken over Earth, given it a new name, but the robots themselves have a little civil war brewing between the free will robots and the robots under the Robot Emperor. And all of this gives Magnus plenty of opportunities, that's right, to fight some robots. I mean, it's kind of in his job title. So it has to happen a couple of times every issue. In issues 25 and 26, this title crosses over with Rye. Those are issues I did not have, and a character I don't know very well. But I was able to follow the action. I was not in love with the art and coloring, and don't know if I'll pick up a ton more of this volume of Magnus Robot Fighter, but I'm glad I picked these ones up just to give me a broader sense of the story. Very solid stuff. But the highlight of these issues is becoming reacquainted with the breakout character of Quarterbin 100, E7, the top hat-wearing robot. Epic! There was another book I read related to episode 100, related to book 100. As a matter of fact, I read Cerebus 172. For context, this is about 65 issues past the one that Luke Jack and Eddie and I talked about on that episode, and about 15 issues away from the uber controversial issue 186. So at this point, Dave Sim is still the self-publishing darling, at the top of his game, still winning Eisners and all that. And this is simply a beautiful book. The use of blank space, the use of prose, panels that float around on some of the pages, it's just terrific. I didn't know what was going on in the story, but it was interesting, and I certainly recognized the quality of it. And then I saw something I never have before, and that is a letter page that was 10 pages long. This is 1993, and Sim is basically inventing what would eventually be online comic book community. The amount of back and forth in these letters, Sim responding to readers, readers responding to him, readers responding to each other. The ongoing nature of the dialogues here, it's really cool. Like I said, nothing I've ever seen in print before. Going further back in the Quarterbin archives, way back at the end of 2013, in Lucky Episode 13, I covered Cage, number 1, from the 1992 series. And since then, I've picked up a few of the later issues in that title. And last month, I read Cage, 2 through 4. And they were okay. Issues 3 and 4 featured the Punisher. And I'm not a big fan of his, but he always adds an interesting dynamic, especially when he's a guest star. This was the case when Punisher showed up in an issue of Darkhawk, that I covered on episode 100. When he arrives, he usually doesn't take a side. He just turns a one-on-one fight into a one-on-one-on-one fight. And that's an interesting dynamic. They did a bit of that when he appeared on the Daredevil TV show. But I don't know how they can do that when he's the lead character and not a guest star. That makes it trickier to get that dynamic that I really like when he does show up as a guest. Another unofficial follow-up, if you will, involves Eclipso. I participated in this year's hashtag best event ever, which covered Eclipso, The Darkness Within. In the May Reading Journal, I talked about 6 or 7 annuals from that event. And when I was going through my reading pile recently, I saw that I had a trio of books that again featured Eclipso. So I read Metal Men 48 and Eclipso 10 and 12. The Metal Men issue came from World's Greatest Comics, an issue from 1976. Bruce Gordon's fiancée seeks out Dr. Magnus for help to stop him from becoming Eclipso. In my head canon, yes, Dr. Will Magnus is, yes, the great ancestor of the robot fighter. Just throwing that out to you. But Bruce Gordon Eclipso's out a few times, beats up the Metalman a few times, and the issue ends with a pretty dramatic cliffhanger ending. As I've said more than once, the Metalmen, to me, I fear, are in that category of characters along with the Challengers of the Unknown and Adam Strange, characters that just might not work in the modern age. But I still love reading their Silver and Bronze Age stories. The two Eclipso books were from 1993. Issue 10 was sent to me by my good buddy, Mark Sweeney from I'm the Gun, who promised that issue 10 was, quote, by far the best issue of the solo series, unquote. And boy, was he right. This is basically a conversation between Eclipso and Darkseid while they're playing chess, with flashbacks to each of their origins. That doesn't sound like much, but it was excellent. Props to Robert Lauren Fleming for being able to script such a dramatic issue for one that didn't really have much action, except in flashback and threats. And props go to one of my favorite underrated pencilers, Colleen Doran. She's best known for a long-running fantasy series, A Distant Soil. And anytime a story has a mythic or fantasy feel to it like this one does, she's a good choice. And she did a great job on this one. A really excellent issue. Thanks for sending that, Mark. And I also read Eclipso 12. And wow, not only was that not even close to being as good as number 10, it was actively pretty bad. My good friend, the kind and generous Sir Martin of Grey, sent a nice care package a few months back. A lovely variety of stuff, truth be told, including The Fearless Defenders 4 and 5. This was a Marvel Now book from 2013 and 2014. It's a completely female team made up of folks like Valkyrie, Danny Moonstar, and Misty Knight. The plot involves Valkyrie trying to assemble a team of Shield Maidens to battle the Doom Maidens, but she can't find anyone worthy here in Midgard. Issue 5 brings together a huge cadre of heroines, including Spider-Woman, Black Cat, Hellcat, She-Hulk, Thundra, Black Widow, Colleen Wing, Elektra, and more, including the totally normal Dr. Annabelle. Didn't get the end of the story here, which is always a bit of a bummer, but Cullen Bunn did a nice job with the storytelling on these two issues. I don't know that I've read much from Bunn, but I know people who think pretty highly of his work, especially Sixth Gun. I also liked Will Slaney's art, and he's someone whose work I was not familiar with, but all the women looked right, looked on model, and all looked strong and powerful and impressive, but not in the stereotypically comic book sensual manner. A couple of solid comic books. And back to Rebirth. I read Batman 9 through 20. This is the I Am Suicide storyline. followed by Rooftops, and then I Am Bane. I'm not the first person to say this, but Tom King is really doing some interesting stuff here with the writing. First, we have Batman assembling a Suicide Squad type team, and they end up going against Bane, although that's not the totality of the storyline, just one episode. And then we have a two-issue focus on Catwoman and on the Catwoman-Batman relationship, which I am not opposed to at all. That dynamic, the flirtation, the attraction, was present in her very first appearance 70-plus years ago. They flirted in that first appearance, and he let her go, much to Robin's misunderstanding and chagrin. So the notion that they have a romance, I have no problems with that at all in theory, and not liking it because it's a retcon or a new development, that's simply not accurate. And here, the story is pretty good, too. Catwoman is about to go away for prison, and this time it's for a long time, multiple life sentences for multiple murders. This has been a controversial part of her backstory here in the rebirth retelling, and we get her side of the story here, and I'll just say it's not exactly as it first appeared. But these two issues gave such an insight into Batman, his view on the world, on criminals, on justice, on Catwoman. It's a really interesting little interlude. And then we get I Am Bane for five issues, which continues that ongoing I Am stories that have filled this Batman title. This takes place over 5 days, one day per issue, and involves a fight between Bane and Batman over Psycho Pirate, who was the subject of the I Am Suicide plot. Batman needs the pirate for 5 days to use his powers to restore the courage and psyche of Gotham Girl. But Bane needs the pirate for his own purposes as well, to use him to remove the pain that he, Bane, is always in. And it's a great use of an underused character, and speaks to both Bane and Batman, that they both recognize the pirate's power, and want to use that power to use him, to be honest. Batman is pretty ruthless in this story, single-minded, probably to a fault, but I think that's a very interesting take on the character. It's quite a different person from the one I'm reading in the equally good, although quite different, Detective Comics. But that doesn't bother me at all. These are two equally good takes on the character of Batman, equally interesting, equally moving storylines, and the fact that they might not be able to be occurring at the same time, inconsequential to me. Quality trumps continuity. The digital version also includes the Tom King Ace the Bat-Hound story from the annual. I love Ace, and it's a great story, especially the snarky ending line from Alfred questioning the world's greatest detective description for Batman. Strange Attractors 1 through 5. This is an independent book from the mind of Charles Soule, and it's pretty far out there idea-wise. The lead character is Dr. Brownfield, a disgraced university professor, a position that I am only one disgrace away from, to be honest. He has mathematical theories that predict the impending death of New York City, and he has spent decades making continuous series of small adjustments to fend off the collapse. He's convinced a young student to join him, Heller Wilson, but will he believe the ailing, perhaps insane, old man, or let the city crumble because of his disbelief? Really interesting story, a complete story. Good art, good characters, and relationships. Overall, pretty good. Descender, 7 through 16. These are the second and third trade of this title, which I talked about a month or so ago when I did the first trade. It's Jeff Lemire and Dustin Nguyen giving us a futuristic story where androids have been outlawed after huge machines decimated human-inhabited worlds a decade or so back. In this world, the young boy android Tim 21 is on the run along with government operative Captain Telza. Along the way, they find Tim 21's twin, Tim 22. You try saying that. They're looking for 21's human companion from back in the day before the attacks, but they end up on the Machine Moon, where the androids are in hiding, plotting their uprising. And it's not just humans and machines. In this future world, there are many, many humans who've had various body parts replaced by mechanical ones, putting them in the between, a third group for this war. And in the third trade especially, we get a lot of characterization for everyone, from the government folk to the betweens to the robots themselves. This is a really well-thought-out world, and Lemire and Gwyn are doing a really interesting story in that world. Really looking forward to reading some more of Descender. Snake Woman, 11 through 15. This is a title I read a few issues at a time last year. It's from Liquid Comics, which has some Indian talent as founders, and this one involves an Indian legend, a snake goddess seeking revenge for an injustice centuries before. By Indian, I'm referring to the Asian country, by the way. The lead character is reincarnated every generation to battle the reincarnated versions of the 68 men who perpetrated that original crime against her. The cycle can only be broken when in one incarnation she kills the 68. Except that in these issues we learn that they are not the only beings locked into this cycle. She meets the troublemaking Snake King, who is pretty sure that he outranks her, the mere snake goddess. She disagrees, and they fight. She also takes on a being who is the avatar of the snake's mortal enemy, the mongoose. That was a turn I did not see coming. And there was another good character to add to the mix. Then we also got the snake charmer, who considers herself an assistant to Snake Woman, actually a worshiper. And then we get the strange sight of all of the 68 and others being drawn to a small village in India, I assume for a final battle of some kind. I like this just because it is so unlike anything I have ever read before. It's not great, but it's solid, and the story itself is so interesting, so different. I just really have no idea where it's going from here. There's no template that I have in my mind for where this story is going to go. Grimm Fairy Tales, 13 through 18. This is another series that I've been reading via the Hoopla digital app. Back in June, I read the first two trades and was surprised by how much I liked them. In this volume, we start to get some info about our main character, super hot literature professor Cela Mathers. We get her meeting with a new character, her mentor, because Cela is having a crisis of faith. We learn that she's been doing this, that is, running across people in trouble and using the lessons from Grimm fairy tales as teaching guides to help them with their situations for a long, long time. But lately she wonders if she's been effective, and her mentor wonders if she's using the book inappropriately, delivering punishment instead of lessons. And at the very end we see that Cela has a dark doppelganger, an opposite number, a thread that I assume is developed in the next volume. And all this is taking place in the context of every issue using a fairy tale to develop a theme or to reflect on the story being told. It continues to be a surprisingly interesting read. I do need to point out one thing about this trade, because it contradicts something that I've said about the first two trades. And that is that although the covers of these issues are all pin-up, good girl type poses, the interior art for the first 12 issues was primarily standard comic book art, maybe a little more sexy, but not overly so. But that is much less the case in these trades. There's much more of that sexy art from the cover included inside the issues. To me, it was still inside the bounds of appropriate, but it was overall much closer to that line than the prior issues were. And I do hope that does not continue to push further and further, because like I said, it's been a surprisingly strong book. I know that there are many, many more trades to go, and I'd kind of like to keep reading the series. We mentioned Iowa's Joe Crawford's recent care package before. Also in that box was Dead Inside 1 through 3, a 5-issue Dark Horse series from 2016-2017, written by John Arcudi. It's a crime story based inside a prison, focusing on the prison bureau detective trying to make sense of a quite confusing crime. The powers that be want her to just let them close the deaths out as a murder-suicide, which is how the crime was staged. But Linda, our hero, knows pretty quickly that something else is going on, and she's going to dig it up. The people associated with the case keep dying, in some cases killing themselves. And she ends up at a crossroads at the end of these issues. What to do next? Tony Fazula does a nice job with the art, giving the various characters distinctive looks, so it's never an issue as to who is who. And the story is interesting enough, and if the trade ever shows up on Hoopla, and a lot of Dark Horse stuff does eventually, I'll borrow it and see how the last two issues wrap it up. And he also sent alongside a single issue of a title that intrigued me enough that when I found some more random issues in the World's Greatest Comics quarter bins, I picked them up. So I ended up reading Warlock and the Infinity Watch 3, 8, and 14. And yes, those issues are kind of far apart. I thought it would give me a chance to learn a bit about a character that I knew very little about. Mostly what I know, I've learned from the episodes of Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos podcast hosted by Al Sedano. This series actually features a bunch of people from the Guardians of the Galaxy movies, although they're not characterized exactly the same. But there's a lot of Drax, a lot of Gamora, Thanos, of course, and some Pip the Troll, and that's rarely a bad thing. There was not a ton of action in some of these specific stories, partly because they were working on a bunch of big storylines, most of which had Infinity in their name. But that doesn't make these stories bad by any means. Interesting character work, good scripting. Jim Starlin knows what he's doing, writing big cosmic characters and big cosmic stories. So I didn't always have the context for the storylines, the plot. But these were all still pretty good reads. In addition to all those kiddie books I talked about before, Rob Lance's recent care package included a few interesting new books. Marvel Comics Digest number 1, starring the amazing Spider-Man. This is the new one that's distributed through grocery stores via a deal that Marvel made with Archie, the undisputed kings of grocery store distribution. And this is a packed digest. I guess it clocks in at a little over 200 pages. And there's some pretty good stories in there. I liked the 4-issue storyline from Amazing 156 to 159. That's from 1976, the era of the late Len Wein and Ross Andrew. This is a Doc Ock and Aunt May storyline with Otto being super protective of May, which is freaking Peter out big time. And then the Hammerhead shows up, which is pretty much Otto's fault. So his priority turns to beating Hammerhead. And Spider-Man helps him on this one. And the idea of Spidey and Doc Ock working together on anything? Well, that's just exactly what J. Jonah Jameson would expect. Nice little arc, just showing how crazy and complicated Spidey's life can be. There are about 5 stories in this digest from the 2000s, including a couple from the mid-2000s, all-ages Marvel Age Spider-Man. This title adapted and redrew old Leon Ditko stories for the new era, placing them in a more modern context and telling them in a more modern style. Much fewer word balloons, quicker read, all of that. The 2 issues in here both feature the Vulture, making this a good tie-in for anyone picking this up after seeing Spider-Man Homecoming. There was a funny moment in there when the Vulture showed up at the Bugle on payday to steal the payroll, which is, of course, a longtime trope in TV shows and movies. But JJJ points out to the old man, they pay their employees via check nowadays, often through direct deposit, wondering just how long it's been since Vulture had a regular job. There are 2 more from Marvel Adventures, Marvel Universe, and a Web Warriors story featuring Deadpool. All in all, a good selection of appropriate stories, a range of eras, and a really good first move into the digest space for Marvel. And Marvel Comics Digest number 2, starring the Avengers. This volume starts at the very beginning with Avengers 1 and 2. In those, we get the team coming together for the first time to battle Loki, and then they're having a general meeting that ends up with them going head-to-head against the Space Phantom. There were a lot of good things going on here, except for Rick Jones and his gang of kid helpers to the Avengers. The sooner that little plot device was jettisoned, the better. We then jump to a three-part story running in Avengers 235, 236, and 237. This includes a guest appearance by Spider-Man, and also a few of his villains, Rhino and Electro. I thought that this was, in addition to being a pretty good story, a pretty wise choice for inclusion, with the idea that the prospective reader for this picking it up at the supermarket checkout may be more familiar with the movie characters than the comic characters. So including as many characters as possible from the recent films who the reader may be more familiar with makes sense. There are also less familiar characters in here, like Monica Rambeau and Star Fox, but there are plenty of familiar folks for any new readers to recognize. We have two issues from the mid-2000s all-ages title, Marvel Adventures, The Avengers, again, selected to appeal to the younger set. I mentioned the appeal to movie viewers, but also the last three issues in here are all tie-ins to the animated series of either Earth's Mightiest Heroes or Avengers Assemble. So both this one, the Avengers Digest, and the Spider-Man one, I think were created very strategically. And I don't know that we know yet how successful these books were, but I definitely applaud the effort. If you're putting together collections that are supposed to highlight the history of these characters and also appeal to younger readers and modern readers, these both seem like the types of collections that could do that. Again, just very well curated and well edited. And two more of my Hoopla finds were, similarly, Archie's 75th Anniversary Digest 1 and 2. Now, Archie does a ton of digital collections in general, and especially last year when it was their 75th anniversary year. But I'm pretty sure that this 12-issue series was actually printed. Yes, I am reading the digital versions, but I don't think these were digital only, like a lot of Archie's collections are. The 224 pages of Volume 1 collect a range of issues from the 1960s onward. Again, very well curated volume containing very early, in some cases first, appearances of Josie and the Pussycats, Cheryl Blossom, Kevin Keller, as well as a spy story in the style of The Man from U.N.C.L.E., an E.T.-inspired story, and a 20-pager with the Mighty Crusaders. And it also included the last issue before their recent, shall we say, rebirth. It was just a nice wide range of comics, and interspersed throughout, there are some two-paged text pieces that discuss the stories that are in that section, and that really helps put context to the stories, what was popular at the time, why they introduced a new type of story, why a new character was introduced, that sort of thing. And those were uniformly interesting and added to the reading experience. I'm pretty sure I'd read maybe a few of these stories before, probably in other digests, but that doesn't matter. Most of it was new to me, and most of it was pretty good. The range of stories in Volume 2 were equally interesting, going back from as early as the mid-1940s, in this case, where Archie more resembled Howdy Doody than anyone else. The original character models are really odd, and it took a few years for them to settle into how the characters would look for the next couple of decades until the TV era, the late 60s and 70s, when the designs were cleaned up again. And those looks remain largely unchanged into the early 2000s. As I said before with the Marvel digests, the selection process, the editing, the curation of these volumes is a really important aspect. And both of these Archie volumes really nailed that, as did the Marvel ones. A nice variety of stories. And I think that's everything. And I'm not going to lie, I went into this fall semester at school pretty well prepared, at least for this first month of it. and I read a ton more comics than I expected. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, again, to repeat, those Archie and Marvel digests were all well put together. That Cerebus book was beautiful. Descender continues to be good. Grim Fairy Tales continues to surprise me by being good. Some of those Rebirth stories, especially the ones with Bruce and Selina, were very good. And Marvel's Greatest Comics 66 was doomtastic. But I'm going with a book sent in by Mark Sweeney from I'm the Gun. He said that Eclipso number 10 was really good, and he was really right. As a matter of fact, that was my favorite read of last month. And remember, I was Joe Crawford. Like I said earlier in the episode, it's not a competition. Keep that in mind, buddy, okay? It's just that Mark won. Next month, I expect that the amount of comics I read has to decline a bit. There are only four Saturdays, so that'll help. So I do expect the episode to be a bit more reasonable in its length. But we won't know about that until that episode comes out, which should be sometime in early November. Feel free to let me know what you think of the episode, what you think of any of the many, many, way too many books that I mentioned. You can send that feedback via email at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. or as a comment on the Facebook or blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek. And of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. And thanks for listening. Keep the pages turning.